90th episode of Reverse Rem Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's Mattia Muralitharan's birthday. Welcome to the podcast that is the Doucera in audio form.
And we're going to be putting you into all kinds of spins today. We're going to be looking back at what's happened over the last few weeks in the world of cricket. Everything from, we're going to be talking about playing cricket in winter in the UK through to what's happening in the Test arena at the moment. I'm going to be talking a bit about the etymology of certain cricketing terms. And we're going to be reviewing The Test, which is Simon Jones's autobiography. So it's a few weeks since we've been on air. What's been catching your attention in the world of all things cricket, Andrew?
The county championship season is up and running, and I think
spring is here.
Exactly, yeah. And actually, it's been quite nice because there's almost been some of the weather for it. That, you know, sometimes playing cricket in April just is completely absurd. But actually, we've had sun and everything, and there seems to be a particular amount of excitement around this season. There's a general feeling that Division One looks really, really strong, and there's also the fun of having some of the England players actually taking part early season. But I've been particularly interested in what was going on at Chelmsford a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, you could be in the IPL in India seeing DLF maximums flying all over the place. But Dan Lawrence at Chelmsford batted for 7.5 hours, making 141 to salvage an improbable draw for Essex against Lancashire. You could have fitted two entire IPL games into that one.
It's stuff that dreams are made of, that kind of innings. Early season, pitch is a bit of a green top, you don't know how it's going to play, you're feeling a bit rusty, your eye's not in, and you just buckle down for 7.5 hours. I mean, God, good on him, good old Dan Lawrence. Do we know much about him?
Well, he's seen as, not surprisingly with innings like that, something of a hot prospect. The England setup is already kind of looking into him.
Chris Tavro, Mark II.
Exactly. And, well, I think this is the point. I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing over the last few years about whether the Chris Tavro-like players were lost to us forever. You know, if you're a teenage batsman in particular, and you look at the money available in the IPL, etc., surely you're just going to focus on being the big-hitting, you know, all-out attack, gung-ho player. But the rise of players like Lawrence and also obviously Hamid with England, also actually someone like Dominic Sibley at Surrey, is showing that there are still young cricketers who are gaining that technique and have that determination to play long defensive innings. In short, the art of the defiant blocker is not being lost. I think cricket is much the better for it.
The defiant blocker. We love a defiant blocker on this podcast. So I've been, my eye was caught the other week by the news that there is a plan afoot to draw the biggest ever crowd seen at a cricket match in the UK. And the idea is that this is going to happen in the 2019 World Cup. So the World Cup in 2019 is being held in England and Wales. And there's a plan to have a couple of games at the Olympic Stadium in London. This is the Olympic Stadium that was built for the 2012 Olympics. It seats around 70,000 people. I think I'm right in saying, but you'll know better than I do, that it's actually now the West Ham football stadium. Is that right?
It is indeed, and that the conversion there has not been without controversy and difficulty.
It's cost a lot.
It's cost the taxpayer a lot. And there's also this ongoing problem that athletic stadiums don't always easily translate into football stadiums. But,
and you know, so much the better then that there is then possibly this outcome where some cricket will be played there, because you know the World Cup is one of those moments where there is a rare opportunity to reach out to a really, really broad audience. And you know, we should be thinking about how do we put this onto the biggest possible stage and, you know, really draw new audiences to it. So, you know, often people who listen to this podcast will, you know, think that we're habitually moan about limited overs cricket and kind of commercialization and things like that, but I think this is probably an example where it's quite exciting.
I think what I'm really excited about, and again, you would have seen this more in Australia, is that in countries with big stadia, you can charge reasonable amounts for tickets. I mean, one of the problems England has had for a long time
is that when your
biggest stadium is Lord's, you create a weird supply and demand thing with tickets. If there's only a small number of tickets, then you can get away with charging actually silly money. My hope would be, and you know, let's see if this comes to fruition, that if you've actually got that many tickets, you can charge an affordable amount for people to come and watch.
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen though, doesn't it? Because I don't think that's always the way that these... I agree with the logic, absolutely. absolutely. And I think Lord's is a third of the size of the Olympic Stadium in terms of seating capacity. But it remains to be seen whether there will be a general view, oh, this is a cash cow that we need to milk as far as we can. Now, so the World Cup's happening in England in 2019. You've been making active preparations to make sure that you're part of the England side for that, haven't you?
Well, indeed. I've been going diligently, well, actually, I'd say semi-diligently, to winter nets in the run-up to the season. And I've always really enjoyed winter nets. There's this wonderful feeling that you're cheating the weather gods. You turn up with your bag we do it at a sort of perfectly nice primary school gymnasium, and it's freezing and wet outside, but you're going to play cricket.
And dark as well, that's the other
thing.
It's dark outside,
miserable.
And you go inside, and then... By the way, I don't know if anyone actually uses the word gymnasium anymore. Maybe that's just you, but I don't think... Not since I last read a Jennings novel did someone use the word gymnasium, but maybe I've just been out of the country for a long time.
I'm trying to keep standards up.
anyway, sorry. But there you are, cozy.
And the other thing is,
night.
I've tried very hard in the last few years to practice with a bit more focus. I think particularly when you're younger, you just go into practice and it's fun and you mess around. And now, because I feel like I get less time than I used to, I try and go in there looking to work on particular aspects of my game. But I have come to the view that the whole thing is really a little bit futile. Changing and improving your technique takes hours of work that none of us really have anymore. We're not at the elite performance centre in Loughborough. We can't just spend an entire morning working on our trigger movement. And in reality, changing your technique is laborious. These things are tied into muscle memory and all this sort of stuff, and we've been doing it for years. And I think, sadly, the best most of us can hope to do is just keep together this ramshackle technique that we've had since we were kids.
But I think there is something quite nice about realizing that, because you suddenly think to yourself, if I did have the opportunity, if I didn't have a day job, and all I did from getting up in the morning to going to bed at night was practice my cover drive, I would be a phenomenal cricketer.
Oh,
and
I'd probably be playing for England.
The only thing holding me back is the fact that there are other demands on my time. If it wasn't that my country needed me in other ways, I would absolutely be out there doing my thing. So, yeah, there you go. Now, one of the changing arena slightly from your evening nets to the test matches of India. One of the things I've always quite liked about cricket is the fact that you can be on a pitch, two teams can be on a pitch kind of hurling missiles at fast pace at one another, and a lot of aggro, a lot of kind of intensity, and then they'll come off the pitch at the end of the day and they'll have a beer together, and that is is a huge part of the kind of the fabric and the folklore of cricket. And this seems to have fallen over a little bit in this series between India and Australia at home in India. And I actually culminated with Virat Kohli the other day saying that he is no longer friends with any of his Australian counterparts, and nor can he ever be. Which seems like an extraordinarily kind of ill-spirited thing to come out and say, particularly when the heat of the moment has kind of passed. Apparently there was an incident where Kohli, I can't remember who was his vice-captain at the time, but when Kohli was injured for the last test, but Steve Smith said to the vice-captain, why don't you come for a beer at the end of the game in our dressing room? The kind of official invitation, captain to captain, let's lay down arms and have a beer together. And apparently Kohli just completely ignored the invitation. And it is a little bit of a worrying tendency when you have these battle lines being drawn so far that suddenly there's no sense of perspective even outside the game that allows you to step back and say, now's the moment for us to have the beer.
I think you're completely right, but I think, sadly, this Kohli-Smith incident is just indicative of a wider trend. You read a lot of stuff about some recent series that England have been involved in, and I think these nice team-on-team sort of bonding drinks after a game, I think they've generally been in decline. I think it seems to be something about the increased professionalism of the game. It's very hard to put a finger on it, because it's not to say, I mean, exactly as you said earlier, it's not to say that cricket in the 80s, 70s or whatever was any less competitive. It was fiercely, fiercely competitive. I mean, I always think of that wonderful image of Alan Donald having worked Atherton over. And Atherton had refused to walk for an instant where he should have been out, and they're having a beer afterwards, and that's exactly what the game should be out. But sadly, this does seem to be part of an ongoing trend, and I think you're going to need probably a very big effort from some of the captains involved to turn that around.
Well, quite as much as anything. I just think it's going to be amusing when Kohli sits down in his IPL changing room next to a whole lot of Australian people, now his teammates, who he's vowed never to be on friendly terms with.
From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to explore the etymology of some of cricket's most intriguing words.
Now, one of the great things about the Easter long weekend is that I get to have Lions, and it's not often that happens. Recently, I've been getting up at kind of 5 o'clock in the morning. You may be wondering where this is going, but I'm going to tell you right now. So often when I have a lion, I lie in bed and my mind wanders and I just stare at the ceiling and think about things. And I ended up thinking about the word Yorker. Thinking about cricket, and I thought, the word Yorker, wonder where that comes from. You know, we use it all the time, and yet I'd never actually thought, where does that word come from? And then I thought to myself, there must be loads of other words like that have become part of our day-to-day vocabulary, but actually we have no idea what their etymology is. Now, quite a lot of words in cricket can be explained by some kind of metaphor one way or other. So for instance, there's the metaphor of war that we have throughout quite a lot of cricket. So, you know, a batsman falls, a wicket falls, that idea of, you know, a bowler coming in and bowling at the death. There's then also,
and of
you know,
course
a
you
lot
get
of,
the death rattle now, don't you? That's very beloved
you do
of
get
commentators.
The death rattle.
The batsman
exactly.
Hears the death rattle, yeah.
There's also those things that are you know, a direct description of something, a kind of almost a pictorial description of something. So a dot ball is called dot ball because there's a dot that goes into the scorebook. A duck is called a duck because a zero is like a duck's egg, as we all know. But there are plenty more whose meaning is a bit obscure. And so, as much as anything, so that you can kind of impress your friends and also be well equipped for any pub quizzes that you might be going to, I thought that I'd explore five of my favourite cricketing etymologies. So the first one is indeed the Yorker, the one that set me off on this mad path. Of course, a Yorker is a fast, full delivery that kind of dives in at the batsman's toes and makes him sort of jump around a bit. And there are a couple of theories about where it comes from. The first of which is simply that it refers to the, you know, to Yorkshire. It was a great, you know, a great capital of cricket, always has been since sort of cricket's golden age in the 19th century. And the idea that this was a ball that came from there, particularly one that came from the great bowler Tom Emmett of the 1800s. So to bowl a Yorker was to bowl the kind of ball that a Yorkshireman might bowl. There's another kind of etymology of this, which is that there's a phrase to pull Yorkshire, and if you pull Yorkshire, it means that you're deceiving, because apparently people from Yorkshire are known tricksters, and so just as a Yorker might deceive a batsman, so a Yorkshireman might deceive someone else. So actually, there's this idea that, you know, this is a tricky ball to bowl. That's why it's a Yorker. There's another explanation actually that suggests that the Middle English word Yorker, Y-U-E-R-K-E-A, means a trick, and that's why again it's a tricksy ball. So as with quite a lot of these etymologies, we don't actually know where it's from, and there's this kind of rich pattern of possible explanations around it.
I've enjoyed the way Yorker has sort of developed and gone on to mean more and more things. So you obviously now talk about a bowler yorking a batsman, so it's been turned into a verb. But my favourite development, which I hear more and more now, is talk of a batsman yorking themselves, which has become more and more of a thing in limited overs cricket, where the batsman tries to be aggressive, goes to the delivery, and then it sort of it becomes a toe-crunching Yorker through the creation of the batsman themselves. And I do
what would have been a good length ball, they turn into a Yorker.
Exactly, and I do enjoy these things where the original word, which meant something quite specific, has now been adopted for lots of other causes.
Now, staying on the letter Y, the yips. Now, the yips obviously is something that no bowler wants to have, and it's a kind of something that stops you from, you know, your natural action from developing. It's a term that's usually used in golf, and this one actually people seem to draw a blank as to where this one comes from. Its first recorded usage is in 1962, and there are a few theories that it actually comes from a yip. So a yip, yips is always referred to in the plural, but a yip singular is the bark of a small dog. And this idea that a kind of yap of a dog and that kind of instant small outburst is a little bit like what happens when, you know, if you see someone putting who's got the yips off and they've got a jerk in their arm or something like that, a kind of quick reflexive reaction, a little bit like a bark of a dog. Bit of a funny one, that one, actually, I think.
I'm fascinated by the fact that, so I get how in the question of something that where you're going back to medieval times or whatever, the etymology gets lost. It's very interesting that something that emerged in 1962, the etymology has to some extent been lost. Because you think either there would be quite clear written record, or frankly, we could just ask, couldn't we? You know, there must
indeed
be people around.
Why
when
did someone start using this word somewhere? Yeah, no, absolutely. And someone needs to do some homework. Someone with, you know, more time on their hands than us, I would suggest. So there are some words whose use in cricket is kind of completely divorced from sport, actually. So it doesn't really have a foundation in sport at all. So silly, so as in silly mid on or silly mid off or silly mid wicket and those kinds of things, is just one of these. And so in a way, it does what it says on the tin. So you do have to be a bit silly to field that close to the bat. But then if you go back to Middle English, the word silly actually means pitiful or defenseless. And again, that's actually a very, very appropriate, you know, there is no more pitiful side than someone at silly mid on, you know, with an off spinner bowling who's standing there just waiting to get a ball between the eyeballs. Talking of fielding position, when I was a child, I used to spend quite a lot of time looking at diagrams of cricket pitches and trying to remember what all the fielding positions were called around the pitch, so that when I was listening to Test Match Special, I could then kind of play it out in my mind. And I realised the other day that actually if someone had just explained to me the etymology of all of the names of the fielding positions, then it would actually have been a lot quicker, because they make a lot of sense. So on the offside, the slips are there because they catch any slips that the batsman might make. If a batsman makes a slip, then the ball flies off the edge of the bat and then it goes to the slips.
Yeah.
Now, the gully is positioned in the gully between the slips and point. And point is stationed where they are because they're at the point of the bat. So if the batsman kind of points his bat out from his body, that points directly out to where point stands. Now, a fieldsman in the covers the middle of the wicket. That's why they're in the covers. And then mid-off is a shortening of middle wicket, off. And the offside is called the offside because a ball heading in that direction is going off the batsman's body, whereas a ball on the onside will be going onto his body and particularly onto his legs. So obviously when you've got your bat and your legs, one side of you has more body than the other side, if you see what I mean. Your leg side is on your body and the bat side is off your body.
This should be cricketing 101, shouldn't it? You know, we should be sitting down with kids and working through this. Because I remember very sort of similar pain. You know, when you're introduced to the game, it just seems totally bizarre. You know, you are really having to learn the positions without any context. You're having to learn them. Although,
and they're words that mean nothing.
No,
you know, words that have come out of nowhere and they have no relation to anything else.
I guess the part of the problem is, however, that cricket fans do sometimes get to the stage where they actually revel in this obscurity. You know, I've seen sort of, you know, people introducing others to the game and reveling in the fact that they can talk about all these mad positions, whereas, you know, the poor person being introduced to the game is left absolutely hopeless. So yeah, maybe we need to be a bit more open in making cricket a bit more understandable.
Indeed. Well, a classic example of that, of one that is completely impenetrable, is the name of the popping crease. So, the popping crease, as we all know, is the crease that sort of doesn't have the stumps on it. It's the no ball line if you're a bowler. You have to have something behind that line if you're a bowler. And if you're a batsman, then it's the line you have to reach in order to not be run out. And there are a couple of theories about why it's called the popping crease. One of them, which I quite like, originates from the rules of cricket in the 18th century, when actually in order to complete a run, you had to, there weren't creases, there was just a hole in the ground. And the batsman had to put his bat in the hole in the ground before a fielder put the ball in that hole in the ground. And if the batsman got there first, he got a run. And if the fieldsman got there first, then he was run out. And both of them were trying to pop the bat or the ball into this hole. In time, the popping hole, as it was then known, became a popping crease, because so often the fielder would be putting the ball in the hole, the batsman would jam his bat in, and everyone would end up with broken fingers all the time. And so they decided that this was madness and kind of changed it. So the other theory, again, which goes back to etymology and is a bit drier, and I don't like quite as much as that rather fanciful last explanation, is that it goes back to the origins of the word pop, which means to hit, and it's the place from which the batsman hits. It's the hitting crease as much as anything.
The interesting thing is that for the most part, we don't seem to reassess and reevaluate this. So the fact that obviously say that last description is right, say that it's because pop used to mean to hit, and we haven't felt any need to sort of reassess the game and describe it as the hitting crease or there's a willingness to stick with what we were given, stick with the inheritance that we've had from
absolutely,
from
and I think
past.
And you know these words do become part of our vocabulary in a really, you know, strange way that we do just accept them and they take on a meaning all of their own, even if we don't know what the exact meaning is. And, you know, new words are being created, you know, all the time. The bloody whatever it is, FLM, maximum, what's it called? The thing in
I
the...
I think it's the DLF, but I might be at least three seasons out of date, to be fair, so...
Whatever it is because of the sponsor, you know, and suddenly that actually becomes a part of the, you know, the lexicon of cricket, as it were. I think there is, you know, in a way, possibly a sad move towards the literal with the way that these things are described. You know, I'm always slightly annoyed when you're watching TV and they have the worm and it looks like a worm across the screen and that's showing you the run rate going up. And you think, you know, if they were making up that in the 18th century, they come up with something far more kind of mystical and far out there than just describing it as a worm. So the review, and for this episode we have been reading The Test, which is the English fast bowlers, well, English / Welsh fast bowlers, Simon Jones's autobiography, subtitled My Life and the Inside Story of the Greatest Ashes Series. It's obviously about the predominantly about the 2005 Ashes. It was actually published in 2015, and it won Wisden Book of the Year. Tom Holland described it as profoundly moving, and Kevin Peterson said, emblazoned on the front cover, "What a man, what a player." It's actually ghostwritten by John Houghton, who many of you will have come across and certainly is someone who we have admired for a long time. He was one of the co-writers of the film Death of a Gentleman. His blog is The Old Batsman. He actually has written a book on boxing as well, I discovered earlier to my surprise.
And
you're
a
boxing
former,
fan, aren't you?
Indeed, and a former interviewee on this esteemed podcast, which I'm sure he keeps
well,
high up on his CV
which,
as well.
Which actually is the thing that when you look at his Wikipedia page, that's the thing that clinches it at the very top. Reverse Web Radio. Anyway, here we go. So Simon Jones, The Test. Essentially what the book does is it takes you through the 2005 Ashes series from Simon Jones's perspective, and it intersperses chapters about each of the tests in that series with reflections on episodes in his life more broadly. Now, Simon Jones is a bit of an elusive character in many ways, in the sense that his test career was a lot shorter than that of many of his contemporaries. He only played about 18 tests in the end. Do you feel like you learned a lot about him from this game? From this book, sorry?
I did, and this format that you describe, I think, works really, really well, and I think this is proof of the advantage of getting a good ghostwriter in, because you do get this very good account of the 2005 series, which I think, actually, having not read about for a while, I was quite happy to revel in the nostalgia of going back to 2005. But I think the real value in this book is in those intervening chapters where he goes into a lot more depth on the challenges of a cricketer's life, and particularly of a fast bowler's life. Via this podcast, I've read an awful lot now on cricket, but I've never read such a moving and impressive account of what it is to be in a profession where you're having to sacrifice your health effectively on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one point he talks about how often a fast bowler bowls pain-free in their career. He estimates that at 5%. He talks about the fast bowler's breakfast of 2 ibuprofen and 2 paracetamol. And it's generally alarming in this book to see how nonchalant they are about some of the things they put their body through. I mean, these constant injections, all of which are dangerous, but, you know, there's almost a lack of, there's not really a choice or question over it. It's like, this is my job, it's my profession, of course I'll do it.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about that format as well, and particularly in relation to what you're talking about, this thing about just the physical nature of being a fast bowler, is that the chapters that talk about his, you know, Jones's career and the struggles that he has throughout it really throw into sharp relief that those times in the 2005 Ashes, where otherwise, you could be inclined to thinking, oh, it's the greatest test series of all time. Of course, you're going to put your body through the ringer a little bit, just get on with it. You're there to win the Ashes for the first time in 20 odd years for England. But you do suddenly realise, because of those broader descriptions of his career, exactly the amount of pain that he must have been going through. And also the thoughts, which actually seem to be in a way glossed over in the book, the thoughts where he must have been thinking to himself, am I screwing my body over for the rest of my career? And eventually, the sad thing is, absolutely he is. He doesn't play for England again after that series.
And I think there's this idea that, we think when you see a fitness report made on, the England team, so and so's injured, so and so's not injured, you realise that actually that's masking the fact that an awful lot of the bowlers in particular are dealing with pain all the time. They're never dealing with being, they're never able to rely on being fully healthy. The book talks about sort of knowing the pain register, the difference between everyday agony and sort of proper agony. And I think the book is very good on pulling out the, as you say, the long-term costs. I think some of the later chapters where his defiant attempt not to retire, to try to keep going, to try and find that one contract more in county cricket, and it's him against his body. I mean, he's being let down again and again, and he's not able to produce. But then I think the book is very powerful on the importance of just that transient, that momentary success. I mean, he's go through so much injury and pain, but he has
Well,
those
what
wonderful moments in 2005.
Well, one of the things that does come across really, really strongly, and I think this is as much as anything a kind of credit to the both to the writing and also to the obviously the way that Jones's story is kind of curated, is that you do feel like you live those moments of euphoria when you're reading it. In a sense, one can feel a little bit over the 2005 Ashes. I've watched that highlights DVD more times than I care to imagine, and I know how every single game ends. But actually, seeing it from Jones's perspective and someone who is so totally invested in it, and is so totally invested in it because of what he's put his body through to be there, actually makes you see it in a completely different light. And there's a astonishing period at the end of the Edgbaston Test. So the Edgbaston Test, obviously, which ends with Kasparovic gloving Harmison down the leg side and Jones takes the catch. But just before that, obviously Jones has kind of dropped a catch down at third man. And reading Jones's description of that is absolutely kind of extraordinary. I'd always sort of written off that moment, thought, oh, it was a bit of a difficult catch, and anyway, it just justified what happened later and the drama that happened later. But suddenly we find ourselves right in the thick of it, in actually a very emotional way, in an emotional way that I think is greater for Jones than it is for other players, because other players went on and had careers, beyond that, and had extended careers before it. But for Jones, this series was his career, essentially. It's what we know him for.
And Jones is quick to point out, and I think it's fair to say he's quick to point out, but without bitterness, that there is an understanding amongst cricket fans that, oh, if you played for England, especially if you played in 2005, you're a millionaire, you're sorted for life. And he makes the point that that wasn't his story. So he finished that Ashes series injured, and at a time when a lot of other players were capitalising on the success, he wasn't in a mental place to do so. His focus was all on getting himself healthy again. And
well,
there's a very telling quote from Kevin Peterson where he says to Jones, mate, why aren't you getting yourself out there? And you can see the difference. I mean, Peterson, who has always shown, and I should say I regard this, I think this is absolutely right. I think cricketers should do this. He's always shown a business nous, a willingness to capitalise on his name, on his brand. I think he saw Jones and was kind of a bit flabbergasted. He was like, look, this is your moment. This is when you make the money that will set you up for your life. Point is, it's that moment, you miss that little window.
You do get the sense throughout the book, though, of Jones being a bit, immature isn't the right word, but you suddenly realise how young he is. When I look back at 2005, I think of Jones as quite a kind of mature guy by that point, but there are quite a lot of anecdotes that come through the book. I mean, the book, very early on in the book, there's the story of him cheating on his girlfriend, and suddenly you do get the sense of someone who is slightly lost in the world, actually, and he's someone who's kind of led astray all too rapidly. So he's the person who goes out, and when he's in the 2003 Ashes in Australia, he's the one who just before selection for the Brisbane Test goes out and gets absolutely hammered and turns up late for the late for the game, and suddenly you sort of realise that this is quite a sort of vulnerable person one way or other.
Well, I think it's this difficulty that, you know, these sports careers are so accelerated. You know, in most careers, you have a chance to mature and grow into things. I mean, in something like cricket, you know, your moment comes before you are mature as an adult. And I think it particularly makes me realise, with all the talk now about, oh, you know, cricketers making all this money in the IPL and whatever, you realise that their moment is so transient. You know, their ability to actually make a career and make a living of it and set themselves up for life. I mean, it's very moving, I think, towards the end of the book, where he has a wife, he has a kid, and he's having to move to Southampton. You know, basically go into sort of like a kind of student flat on a kind of, you know, very low wage salary. And you think, this is a guy who a few years ago was on the, you know, at number 10 being feted, you know, picking up his OBE from the Queen and all this. And I think it's one thing that the book brings across very, very clearly. This is not a sort of career ladder profession. This is a transient, difficult profession where in many cases you're left to relish those great memories, but without any stability, that they've not necessarily given you any long-term stability.
So there you go, that is The Test, Simon Jones's autobiography, published by Yellow Jersey Press. I don't think I've ever come across before, and available, I'm sure, from all good bookshops and Amazon and the like. I think we would both heartily recommend it. Always a bit wary about kind of, you know, contemporary autobiographies. I think there is something to be said actually about the fact that this was written 10 years after the fact. It wasn't something that was out by, you know, Christmas after the Ashes had finished in September. There's clearly a lot of thought that's gone into this, particularly in the choice of getting John Hotten to ghostwrite it as well. So that was the 90th episode 90th. Of Reverse Web Radio. We're in the nervous 90s.
Help us get to
100. A roar from the crowd and a few kind of wides and no balls will probably help as well. Thank you for bearing with us. We will not leave it so long until the 91st episode. As ever, head over to Twitter at @ReverseSwept, where you can send your thoughts our way. You can also on iTunes actually download our entire back catalogue. That's what I'm going to call us, our back catalogue, and get stuck into the 89 episodes that have gone before this too.